From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Unlike marriage, dating is relatively new. The word itself, in that context, doesn't even appear until the last part of the 19th century. But like marriage, which is an institution that involves a kind of contract, the scholar Moira Weigel says dating also plays out in economic terms. Dating, she says, is courtship that takes place in a free market. And in fact, it's always been tied to work. In her new book, Weigel says dating itself is work, physical work, and maybe more importantly, emotional work. Today in the program, Weigel is joining us to talk about the history of dating, which may give us a sense of the future of dating. She says if marriage is a long-term contract, dating often feels like the worst form of labor, the unpaid internship. Her book is Labor of Love. After the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you survey the dating landscape, you know there are all kinds of ways single people try to find each other. You've seen the apps, the websites. And in fact, digital technology and the hookup culture has made some observers wonder if dating is dying. But the scholar Moira Weigel says it's another one of those things people are just overreacting about, because dating isn't going away. It's just changing. It's always changing. It changes with attitudes, changes with the economy. Weigel's new book is called Labor of Love. And that word, labor, is important because dating, she says, is tied to work. And dating itself is work. Weigel has written for the New York Times, the New Republic, among other publications. She's working on a PhD in literature at Yale University. She joined us yesterday from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. And I began by asking what got her started on the idea. Was it a professional interest or a personal one? She said both.
I feel as if I started getting inspired to write this book when I realized that my scholarly interests and my personal interests could overlap in this way. I think it was around 2012, 2013 when I started first really forming the idea for this book. And I was reading all these articles about, like, The End of Men was a big book that had come out. There's a big book called The End of Sex. Yeah. The New York Times had this big article called The End of Courtship. And, you know, both personally, as a person who wasn't married yet, was still sort of dating, and as a historian, someone who looks at culture, I didn't want to believe those kinds of huge sweeping claims. So in a way, it really was both, you know.
It's interesting, though, you say that when you started writing, you started to realize that you were trying to make a life according to these certain rules. And they were rules, you say, that you didn't really understand. And it was sort of blinding you to what it was, in fact, that you were actually looking for, what you actually wanted. Explain mm-hmm. that.
Well, I think, you know, all people probably, but particularly straight women, from the time when we're very young, we absorb all these things about what a romantic relationship should be like, what gender roles should be like. And I think, and I would revise that, I think straight men absorb quite a lot of it too. I think LGBT people have a different situation, which in many ways is better, actually. Yeah. But from when we're very young, we absorb all these messages, you know, from movies, from books, from what our family members say, that are often, I think, all the more strong because they're subliminal, mm. and that say things like, you know, you should want to play hard to get, or a woman, you know, shouldn't initiate a romantic interaction, or a man should be strong and not emotional in this way, you know, all sorts of very fundamental messages. And I think that we absorb them, you know, as if these are just facts of the world, facts of nature. And I think often they can feel quite confusing. I mean, one thing you realize when you research the history of dating is that everyone has felt anxious and confused about it always.
Right, right.
And I think that often those messages aren't great messages, or that they don't necessarily serve personal happiness. I mean, the most obvious example maybe is certain beauty standards. I think a lot of those beauty standards have more to do with getting people to buy gym memberships and clothes and makeup than about, you know, happiness or even sexual attraction. So I think that on the one hand, there are certain messages that it's helpful to dispel. But on the other hand, I also think just getting some clarity on these very strong messages that we often receive in this sort of anxious, stressful context of like, will anyone ever like me? Will anyone love me? Am I good? Yeah. You know, that just bringing clarity even before we get to, you know, what should we do about them or what would be better? Just bringing clarity to where they come from felt very salutary to me, felt helpful. And I hope it is for readers, too.
One of the things you write about is that the problems that people have always encountered with dating is that this isn't just about individual issues or individual traits. You say, and you sort of come to this conclusion at the end of the book, that dating really is about these larger forces, that it's about, certainly about the economy, and we'll talk about that. But I'm guessing mm-hmm. it's also about culture. I mean, these are some pretty big social forces. And I'm wondering, I guess this is a way of just sort of letting people off the hook a bit, which is to say that there's a lot going on with dating. It's not just about you. There's some pretty big forces at play here.
I think that's right. And again, I hope, you know, I think we can interpret that as either really like as liberating or as like kind of really depressing.
Yeah.
But I feel it's funny. I've done so many shows and readings and talks now where people call in and have questions they want answered. Mm-hmm. And so often it seems to me that people just want to say, and maybe this is true of all advice, but people call in and it seems like the subtext of what they're saying is like, this is how I feel. Is that okay?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And it's, I had a woman call in a while ago on a radio show talking about how she was in her 40s or 50s, divorced, and how she felt exhausted by dating and didn't want to do it and felt that she was held to all these really unfair expectations about attractiveness and about, and she was, and you know, she's busy with her kids. She just didn't want to. And she was like, is that okay? And I was like, sure, you know, it's fine if you don't want to. But I think just all that to say, I think sometimes that recognizing these large systemic forces, at least for me, and I hope for some other people, can be helpful because it does help you not be so hard on yourself. Mm-hmm. I think that, again, especially straight women are often told to blame themselves, or we tend to blame ourselves as individuals for whatever's wrong in our love lives. And I think that that can actually increase this anxiety or sense of confusion that I found, and I think others have found too, can be sort of counterproductive.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that the idea of labor, did you begin with that? I mean, this idea that dating was connected to the idea of labor, of the economy, or was that something you found as you went along?
I think I intuited it at one level. I mean, I remember one of the light bulb moments when I decided I really wanted to write this book was when I realized how much of the language we use to talk about dating is economic. And yeah. I think I was reading some of like the eternal articles my mom and aunts send me that are like about hookup culture or something and how people are just hooking up and not courting properly.
Yeah.
And I noticed that these young women who are being quoted in the articles spoke about their intimate lives like exclusively in economic terms. So they'd say, oh, I don't have the time to invest in a relationship. Cost-benefit analysis is I can get my needs met by a friend with benefits. You know, this is all work language, and that interested me. And when I started looking into the history, I discovered immediately this thing which maybe should have been obvious but was not to me, which is that the history of this social form that we call dating, where we believe each person is responsible for finding their mate and that everyone is sort of free to figure out how to do it, you know, as opposed to arranged marriage mm-hmm. or older kinds of courtship systems, which have been the norm in the entire world for most of human history.
Right.
That history starts, the history of dating, the invention of dating happens when women go to work.
Yeah.
When women start working outside the home, and that's absolutely central in terms of young people of all genders having the freedom to meet and mix, women having more mobility in public, but also in terms of this anxiety about gender roles where it's like, oh, are women being too aggressive? Mm-hmm. Should women not act as if they can just go out and meet whoever they want? Should you pretend you didn't get his text message? And I really felt compelled by the topic. I mean, what really sealed the deal for me in terms of wanting to write a whole book about it was this realization that the history of dating is the history of women in the workforce.
Yeah. So I guess it wasn't surprising that how gendered all of this is. You mentioned in the book, people still think of dating as work for women, play for men.
I think that there is still real truth to that,
yeah.
even though we'd like to think, you know, that we could call a woman a player
right.
and say a man's giving it away for free and be sort of equal opportunity. But I think that we do still think of those concepts in very deeply gendered ways.
We'll explore this more, but you mentioned the story of dating really begins when women left their homes and the homes of others they were working in, like being governesses or maids, and moved to the big cities.
Yeah. Our slaves, a very important part of right. American history of women in homes, too.
Right, right. So I guess I'm interested, before we sort of get to that point, what was it like before all of that? Where did these courtship rituals take place before? What was dating like? I mean, was there... There wasn't really dating, but so how would you meet people? I mean, what was it like before that?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. I think, again, it's evidence of how deeply we tend to sort of naturalize or eternalize things we learn about courtship, that it's really weird that we never even think about something like dating having an invention before dating. And I do take it very specifically to have started in like the 1890s,
yeah.
This thing we call dating. That's when people start using the word. Before
1896
that, there are a couple.
1896, yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And there's a specific newspaper column, which is the first time it's on the print record. But before that, there are a couple different ways people meet, young people meet one another and find mates. It varies by class, it varies by race and social situation, but the constant is that it is always in a setting that is private, that's either in a home or a synagogue or a church. It is always supervised by older people. You know, we can think of the Jane Austen scenario where someone sits there with her mom and people come to, you know, men come to call on her. The middle classes call this practice calling. Or, you know, if you're a factory worker, maybe you meet at a factory dance and bosses of factories would throw dances so their workers would reproduce, you know, which is a really important thing for the economy. Or if you're in the country in a little town in the United States, sometimes whole villages would organize like inter-village mixes, which often a church would supervise. So there are all these different ways. But what they all have in common is that it happens in private. It's supervised. There are relatively clear scripts for how it's supposed to go. There isn't this sense of a free-for-all that you get as soon as young people start doing this thing they call dating and going out together into public, into market spaces, I would say, which I imagine we can talk more about.
Yeah. At some point in the process, and it seems like pretty early on in the process, dating is kind of aligned with sex work. You've always talked about the fact, and this is kind of an important, I think, theme, or at least an element of the book, that it's kind of blurry, that line between dating and sex work. In fact, you say it suffers from, you call it a prostitution complex.
Yeah, well, I think a thing that sort of another surprising fact that maybe shouldn't have surprised me is that the first women who make dates, which is what they tend to call it, are working class women. They're immigrant women, women of color, women who've just arrived from the countryside in American cities. There's a huge economic crisis starting in 1893 in the United States, which sends young people running to the cities to try to find work who might not have needed to find work so urgently if the economy wasn't so bad.
Yeah.
And these first women... It's very practical why they start dating. Their parent families don't have parlors. Mom isn't like sitting around waiting for some guy to come over. And so it's really driven by necessity. And so the first women who are doing dating are, you know, on the one hand, I would say they are motivated by economic need. It's then as now, but then even more dramatically than now. In my research, I found women talking about dates saying, "Look, of course I let this man take me for a hot dinner. If I didn't let him do that twice a week, I would never eat a hot meal."
Right.
They're often very poor. And so, I mean, there is an economic driving force both in terms of why women start dating and then how the dynamics of dates play out. People often ask me about why men pay on dates or where that custom comes from. And it's very straightforward. It comes from economic inequality, which is still a thing, unfortunately. But the sex work thing... Again, it's interesting because for us, what looks like the sort of most traditional kind of date, you know, a man asking a woman to dinner to authorities around 1900 looked crazy because there'd never been a situation where young men and women went out. Certainly never a situation where a man paid for something for a woman for considering him romantically. you know, or sexually. Mm-hmm. And that looked like sex work. It is a hard line to draw. Of course, you know, what separates having someone pay for a dinner for you and then you have sex with him versus someone giving you a certain amount of money that a dinner costs to have sex with him? It's a blurry line. It's something that I think still does sort of dog dating relations as much as people wish it didn't. And for what it's worth, I mean, I did interview sex workers for the book, and I read a lot of writing by sex workers. I often think they're the smartest people on these matters. They still call it dates, making a date. You still say you have a date with a John or something. So that's this idea that it's blurry at the boundaries. Or I talk in the book about how certain sex workers use Tinder to find clients, or clients use Tinder to find them, who may also be using Tinder just in their regular dating lives, their non-paid dating lives too. Right. So there is always this fuzziness at the boundary, I think, of what separates it. And any element where there's, you know, because dating so centrally involves someone spending money on something for someone else, I think that there's often a bit of anxiety about that transactional element.
I was really interested in sugar dating.
yeah.
Would you say something about that? Because you talked to a sugar dater?
Sugar baby, yeah.
Sugar baby, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Daddy and baby, yep. Yeah. Yeah, so sugar dating, I guess this app or this platform was founded, gosh, I'm embarrassed to say I'm forgetting. I want to say 2009 or around then. But sugar dating is that specific phrase is associated with a company called Seeking Arrangement, which was founded to let, I think in their own words, people with money meet people who want to spend time with them. So like every escort service, because in the United States, what distinguishes illegal sex work from legal escorting is money being handed over. The site is very cagey about how money is exchanged or what the point of it is, but it's pretty straightforward if you visit it that the point is to connect usually older people with money, usually men with usually younger people who want money, usually women, and it's sort of just a platform for them to meet. And I interviewed a woman who'd done that work in a couple different states. A whole other element, which I get into in the book, of this sugar dating thing is it's very much focused on universities, this particular company, and people with massive amounts of student debt. Of course, it's hard to separate how much of, as with everything in sex work, how much of that is fantasy that, you know, older people like this idea that they're helping a student or find something sort of salacious about it. But the company Seeking Arrangement has branded itself very heavily as sort of helping students, and they offer free memberships if you can supply a .edu address. And they actually hold meetups at some of the most popular sugar baby universities. I think NYU is near the top of the list every year. The woman I interviewed went to Princeton. And she was very interesting, very smart, talked about how she had been doing copywriting and really hated it. And she found selling this kind of service less demeaning, actually, than selling her artistic or linguistic ability, and that it took less time.
Yeah.
And then she was sort of an artist on the rest of her time. So I think that people have all different reasons for using it. But yeah, it is this, it's a very much evidence of this blurry boundary line where they call it dates. You know, they call it I forget what exact euphemism they use, but a sort of, they often speak of it as a mentoring relationship, which in a way is the creepiest to me.
Yeah.
They talk about it as career advancement. But that's a very good example of the ways in which, you know, at the edges, there often is this ambiguous line. And by the way, another part of the ambiguity is, of course, you know, girlfriend experience type sex workers, people who have a long ongoing relationship with a client, mm-hmm. often do have an emotional bond with them. I mean, that is a kind of relationship, even if it's not one we tend to think of in a romanticized way. So it's definitely a good example of the blurry boundary.
Moira Weigel, her book is Labor of Love, The Invention of Dating. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West and KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Moira Weigel is talking about her new book called Labor of Love. In it, she tracks the history of dating. At what point does the middle class start to accept dating as legitimate? Seems like around the 20s or something. That I guess college campuses started to play a role in all of this.
Totally. And I always joke, you know, dating was invented in 1896 and becomes mainstream in 1916. So there's like this 20-year window. In 1916, the Ladies Home Journal, which is the widest circulation magazine in the world, and I'd say very respectable, maybe even stuffy, runs a story about a young, you know, white, middle-class, quote-unquote nice girl making dates with a member of a fraternity. So it's like it uses the word, it puts it in scare quotes, which is funny, but doesn't define it. Seems to assume the audience knows what it's talking about and that it's a reasonable thing for a young woman on a college campus to be doing. Schools are totally central, both the universalization of high school, of co-ed high school in the United States, which starts around 1900, and then the entry of larger numbers of women into colleges play a big role in making dating sort of not only mainstream, but sort of aspirational in a way, something that seems glamorous and everyone wants to do. I think if we think of like F. Scott Fitzgerald and, you know, This Side of Paradise or even The Great Gatsby in a way, the Roaring Twenties, that's this moment where it goes from being something that working class people do to being something that sort of upper or upper middle class people do and becomes a source of like fascination and aspiration. There are lots of movies in the '20s. The actress Clara Bow, who's a very famous actress in the 1920s, is in this movie called The Wild Party about college students. And it becomes sort of this cool thing.
It seems like, so in some ways, I think I read a review of your book where someone put it, it was the rich who copied the poor and then the middle class copied the rich.
Definitely. That's very, I would definitely say that's right.
Yeah.
And so, it's interesting too,
No, go ahead.
I was going to say like when you think about beauty magazines and like movies and all these new forms of culture that you get starting in the 1920s. You know, the big movie studios are founded in the early to mid-20s. You have these big national circulation movie magazines and fashion magazines cropping up. It's also like because at that moment you have this new kind of national culture where like everyone's going to see the same movie, everyone's reading the same magazines. I think that also really helps it spread dating from little college campuses or from, you know, a city like New York or Chicago sort of across the whole country and helps make it middle class and sort of very widely mainstream.
Yeah. What did you find, by the way, about the way dating is reflected, has been reflected in film? Not just in you referencing an older film, but what are you seeing in the films of today that give you a sense of where dating, what people are thinking about dating culture today?
It's a terrific question. It's funny. For the release of my book, I programmed a film series in New York that was like all movies about dating through history. And it was like a really fascinating opportunity to look at it. I feel like movies are always double-edged where it's like on the one hand reflecting certain things about reality, but also things we want to believe about reality. The real heyday of the romantic comedy, which I think even though they're old, people still do think of and inform how we think about dating, is like the 1980s and 1990s. I think of like Nora Ephron comedies, When Harry Met Sally, Pretty Woman, all these different stories about love and how it should go that I think it's funny. I've thought about this a lot. I think, you know, you would never go to one of those movies on an early date because it would be so uncomfortable. But I think that they're really for going to with your friends. And then you're like, they're almost like philosophical dialogues. It's like, oh, is it true that men and women can't be friends? Or is it true that, you know, the ideal relationship is between a sex worker and a banker, which is like a whole other thing I'm obsessed with. But now it's interesting now because I'd say that just off the top of my head, I feel like maybe since Sex and the City, more of our cultural thinking about dating has happened through TV than in big movies. Like I feel like, you know, there are movies like Knocked Up or what was that movie? Oh, gosh, I'm forgetting their names. There's the one where two friends decide to try to have a baby platonically and surprise, surprise, fall in love over the course of the movie. Yeah. There's a new Bridget Jones movie coming out. But I think that a lot of the thinking about it gets worked out through TV series, which is, and Aziz Ansari has his show now.
What about Trainwreck? I mean, Trainwreck was seen.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Well, Trainwreck, I think that there's this really interesting thing happening in our culture right now where we're seeing the rise of female stars.
Yeah.
who very explicitly reject the kinds of pressures, you know, to be thin, to be pretty, to manage your sexuality well. I think Amy Schumer from Trainwreck is a great example of that. Lena Dunham is, Mindy Kaling, you know, Alana Glazer, or it's Alana and Abby from Broad City. We're seeing all these cultural phenomena that are basically women who are like too fat, too loud, too slutty,
yeah,
don't manage their lives. And that's really interesting to me because I do think it's very much part of this moment that we're having now where feminism is cool and women are sort of fed up with certain old beauty standards. So that's definitely seems like, I don't know, that Trainwreck is so interesting because it is in some ways a rebellion against
yeah.
older conventions of the romantic comedy.
Yeah.
At the same time, I mean, it is about a character learning to grow up in certain ways and accept the couple form. There is, you know, I hate to say this, but there is, you know, the soulful black friend, you know, just Dave Chappelle and you've got male and now it's LeBron James.
Yeah.
But I think there are certain very old tropes. But it does feel new. And I think, you know, all these shows that I'm naming, like Girls and Broad City, I guess the Amy Schumer show, they're not centered around heterosexual relationships or like the formation of couples. Those things happen in the show, but it's not the central focus.
Yeah.
And that does also signal, like, there are shows about friends more than about romance,
right.
I'd say. And so maybe we are living in this moment where people are interested in exploring other possibilities, or women don't feel that you know, forming a couple is the central event of their lives necessarily. I think that's a good thing, I think.
Well, you yourself write about, I think this is in the afterword of the book, you talk about
yeah.
two relationships that
yeah.
really start to sort of cement themselves as you're finishing the book. One is the fact that you get married, and we'll come back to that. But the other is a friendship, this really strong friendship you have. Would you say something about that?
Definitely. And God bless you for asking that, because literally nobody has ever asked me about that. And to me, it's so if the only context I've ever gotten to talk about this is when people say, what has no one asked you about? And I get to say my friend Mal, who I really thought through a lot of this book with. But it's such so this book was very much the product of a collaboration, or like grew out of a friendship with my best friend from Yale, where I'm doing my PhD. And I've written some things with my friend Mal. I mean, I feel like we were living together for part of this. A lot of the ideas in this book, I would say, are hers as much as mine. You know, there are jokes she told in it. And I think that female friendship is often sidelined. I think in the cultural stories that we have about the lives of women, you often have the female friend as like, it's like this focus group you have until you find a partner and then it gets dissolved or something. And that friendship is really vital for me and, you know, is as important in many ways as my marriage, which I don't say to belittle my marriage, you know, but it's a very significant relationship. And I think that, you know, there's something that's very interesting to me, too. I always say, you know, all books are co-written pretty much. I mean, you're always living with other people, talking with them. I always think of, you know, Vladimir Nabokov and his wife Vera cooking all the dinners and getting all the books dedicated to her. There are some very clear. There's a new book called Who Cooked Adam Smith's Dinner, which I haven't read yet, but I love the title.
Yeah.
but I think that there's this whole, and it's women, right? There's this whole history of women getting erased from the history of literature. And the history of philosophy and thinking, because they're the ones washing the dishes and cooking the dinner and doing all these kinds of houseworky things that are, you know, it seems very obvious that that work is ignored and undervalued. And then, you know, the man's name is on the book.
Yeah.
More nebulously, there are these things like our friends, the people we talk to, where ideas are always formed in conversation. So anyway, that's all a very roundabout way of saying this friendship that the book really grew out of and, you know, grew, I feel like germinated inside this friendship, is deeply important to me. And I wanted to honor that as like a significant and ongoing part of life. Because I think another thing is that in a way, I feel like the way our culture can fixate on heterosexual monogamous relationships, you know, a certain kind of romantic relationship as being more important than any other relationship, actually is bad for the heterosexual monogamous relationship. I mean, I think that the amount of pressure that we place on this idea of finding this one person who's going to be everything to you, you know, people always now say, I married my best friend, which is a very interesting thing to me. But that actually, I think, can be very counterproductive for the romantic relationship as well as for the other relationships. So I wanted to honor that female friendship that this book, I mean, the book's dedicated to her and my husband because they're the two people I thought through it with. But I think that to get back to where we were coming from, that things like Elena Ferrante and Broad City and Girls all reflect an interest in that sentiment to me, like how women's lives happen among other women as well as, you know, vectored toward marriage or whatever it is we've usually seen portrayed.
Yeah. I want to ask you about one of my favorite sections really surprised me. And this was this question you raise in a chapter early on in the book about who's in and who's out.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause you write about how as dating now starts to become more mainstream, it starts to draw these lines about who's in and who's out. And you get to this bigger question about, gosh, it was so fascinating how gay dating has an influence on heterosexual dating. Let's talk about this idea of what we mean by being out, how you get at that in the book.
Well, gays and lesbians are always in the avant-garde of dating, which I love. And I talk about in the book how, you know, before you have speakeasies, you have gay nightclubs. Before you have straight singles bars, you have the gay bar. And, you know, now before we have Tinder, we have Grindr. There's sort of like this regular pattern to all that. The idea of out, I got really fascinated. You know, the book, I built these chapters around ideas that we sort of take for granted in dating. And I thought about all the different valences of out, of being out. And, you know, we go out in public. We say we go out with someone. This idea of leaving private space and going into public is a big part of how we think about dating. You know, that's why it's not really a date. If you stay at home, even if you spend intentional time together.
Right.
At the same time, there is this, of course, this history of the idea of being gay and being out is very central. And there's so much emphasis placed, again, on claiming a certain kind of identity in public, like going out to not have to hide around, to say, you know, who you are and what you desire. Interestingly, I think that may actually be changing because of new technologies in a way we could talk about. But yeah, the gay history is fascinating. And it is always this back and forth where it's practices and kinds of, you know, dating habits that are marginal, as soon as they become big enough, get like co-opted by the mainstream. So you have sort of fun gay parties in Harlem, and then there come to be these Harlem nightclubs in the 20s and 30s that are sort of too expensive for any of the original people who had those parties to go to.
Right.
And you see it with disco music. You know, disco music is started by queer black DJs in the Bronx and downtown. And then within a few years, you know, they're letting only a few gays into certain disco nightclubs as decoration or whatever.
Yeah.
And so there's this regular pattern. And it's hard because on the one hand, you know, one of a very, very, very deep held belief in liberal democracies in general, I think, is that if a minority makes itself known, they'll like gain recognition. And that's a positive process. At the same time, I think, you know, you can get priced out of the places you made cool. You can get, and the lines are always being redrawn. So we've seen, for instance, these tremendous advances in gay rights in the United States in the past decade or so. At the same time, the predicament of like trans people is still extremely precarious. So it's always a back and forth, I think. And the line is always getting redrawn. As soon as the line is expanded, it's still being redrawn
right.
in a new place.
Yeah. So talk about this. You mentioned technology. How has the smartphone changed the way we think about going out?
The smartphone has completely changed the way we think about going out. I think it's funny because as a historian, you're often inclined to say, oh, nothing is new. You know, every time someone says something is new, you say, no, that happened in the 1780s or whatever.
Yeah.
But the smartphone really is radically new in some ways. I think there's sort of two phases. The internet impacts dating in two phases. There's this early chat room cyber sex phase where the internet is still something that lives on your desktop and is sort of like this imaginary other space where you might go and have an internet boyfriend or internet girlfriend, but it's sort of separate from quote unquote real life.
Mm-hmm.
Then with the rise and spread of the smartphone, it becomes the case that you can carry that imaginary world in your pocket with you everywhere you go. And because of more and more people getting online and the ways that our real life identities, and I always put real life in quotation marks, but our real life, because I think online life is real too. I mean, yeah. It's all part of life. Yeah. But our real life identities are more and more closely mapped onto our virtual identities for most of us. That really changes. And so, yeah, the possibility of having a smartphone on just really changes the boundaries between public and private, not only in dating. You know, we talk about this with Facebook and sharing private images or Instagram. But I think for dating specifically, it does a few things. It A, creates the sense that you could always be dating. You're sort of like always and never dating. You can pull out your phone and like play Tinder in whatever 5 minutes of random free time you have. So you're sort of always both out and in. You know, your profile's out there. There's a new app, I think, called Happn, that's based on people who walk past you. It basically gives you a stream of profiles of anyone you walk by in your daily life. I think it actually seems kind of sweet. But, you know, if you go, it'll show you how long ago you walked by a person, you know, on the street or in the subway station or in line at the coffee shop. And I think, and it tells a timestamp how long it was ago that you passed that person. Right. And that to me seems like a real literal, you know, concrete example of how you're like still out there. Your digital trace is still there in the coffee shop, even though you no longer are. But so we carry the whole world in our pockets, at least in theory. And that means that we're sort of always out and in. You know, you can always be looking for someone or putting your, you know, maybe leaving your digital avatar out there on OkCupid to look for people. So it definitely has rewritten that line dramatically. It's rewritten all sorts of things, too, in terms of how we perform relationships once we're together. When you think of the importance of, you know, the Facebook status or of couple-y photos together, this doesn't reflect well on me, but I remember dating someone for a little while I thought I didn't want to be with for a long time. And him trying to take pictures of us on this bike ride, and I was like, no, I don't want to wreck us together. It was exactly, and also, and people talk about this with cheating. I mean, there are all sorts of ways in which it's cell phones have changed how our relationships unfold, but it's definitely especially pronounced in that in-out thing, and this idea of, like, what is it even to date, you know, is playing Tinder dating. Maybe.
But that app you mentioned is kind of a lovely idea. Because you say in the book that we can lose track of the larger goal here, that this is about love. That seems right. like a nice indicator that maybe some of these patterns could fall by the wayside. Maybe not the economic ones, but there are some patterns that we can sort of get away from as we look at dating in the future, you think?
I think so. I think people are definitely getting more sophisticated about seeing that, you know, these sites and these apps, they're designed to make you addicted to the site and the app. I mean, that's their business model, which I don't say to like unequivocally hate on them. I think that they're really useful tools and can be really great. But I think that we are seeing a certain kind of fatigue with the apps. It's funny, I'm writing a magazine story right now for Marie Claire about how there's been a huge growth in demand for human matchmakers. People are going more and more to, like, there's a new sort of class of millennial matchmakers who help people manage the apps or find people in real life. And I think that that's a real symptom, both of just general exhaustion with the apps and also people recognizing that this idea of infinite choice and sort of infinitely shopping around on the app isn't necessarily furthering what you say, you know, the real goal of forming an intimate connection with someone, you know, whether it's for your life or for one night or whatever it is, but that they're not necessarily, the apps don't necessarily facilitate that, or the way we use them don't always ideally serve that end.
That's Moira Weigel. Her book is called Labor of Love, The Invention of Dating. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Moira Weigel. We recorded it yesterday from a studio in San Francisco. Her new book is about the invention of dating, and in it she examines how the process of looking for love is shaped by these big forces and how it shapes us. The book is called Labor of Love. You write in the book about that self-help books, romantic self-help mm-hmm. books. And this was really interesting. You said that you noticed this difference between business self-help books and romantic self-help books. So in business, yes. they say, trust your gut. In romance, they say, don't trust your gut. Question your gut. What's that about?
It's fascinating. I started thinking of realizing this when I was literally just writing down titles of dating advice books that I felt I should read for this book. And, you know, as a woman, I sort of knew this experientially already, but it was so striking. Like you're saying that the business books are all like, brag, lean in, ask for it, be confident. All these women's self-help books for business. And then the dating books say, you know, it's not him, it's you. Like, you're doing it wrong. Follow the rules. I think there are a few reasons for this. I'm just thinking because it is a persistent feature of dating and dating self-help and dating advice. It's very striking. When I read books from the 1800s that were sort of advice books on how to do calling, to do that sort of courtship ritual in the home, they all advocate being straightforward and open. They say, show your character sincerely and modestly and plainly. And then as soon as you get to this new kind of courtship practice where, you know, men and women are mixing in public in this way and dating, all the advice is about hiding what you feel and saying, you know, well, you think you want to do this, but don't do that. I always joke that, you know, the rules, that big book, The Rules, you could sum up as whatever you want to do, do the opposite.
Right.
But I think that, you know, I think a lot of it, two things come to mind. I think part of it is this thing about gender roles and how now, even in 2016, a lot of people are uncomfortable with the idea of women having sexual agency or women taking the initiative. And often the advice in these books says, you know, it's all about playing hard to get in a certain way that really almost feels like, I don't know, that we long in some way for this sort of ritual of the Jane Austen parlor where it's like a man has to make the advance and the woman there is waiting as like kind of property to be claimed or not. I think it's more I actually think the Jane Austen situation isn't that bad, so I don't mean to hate on it. But I think that in a way it's informed by discomfort with female power, both economic and sexual. I think at another level, dating is just very confusing and anxious making. And as I was saying, you know, the funny thing I realized writing the book is that in every single era, people are freaked out about how dating's happening and saying young people are doing it wrong. This isn't the way we did it. And I think that people sort of crave a rule system that's like, here is, if you just follow these rules, it will be okay, because it's something where we do feel so vulnerable and so anxious. So the idea of someone coming and handing you a book called The Rules, where, you know, there are 32 of them or whatever, is sort of comforting and appealing. I think it's ultimately kind of destructive, but it is, I understand why people crave it. Of course, it's also a business. I mean, I sometimes think the subtext of almost every single self-help book for straight people is like, here's what a man's like by a man, and like, here's what a woman's like by a woman. That it's like this belief that the minds of the opposite sex are like totally mysterious and that you need some expert to explain them to you is very convenient for an industry that's predicated on selling people books that explain them to you. You know, Steve Harvey has this big book called Act Like a Lady, Think like a Man. Which is like, but it's like, Steve Harvey is a comedian. He's not a psychologist. But there's this idea that almost anyone can become an expert just in virtue of, and often, you know, in all kinds of advice literature in America, usually academics who are actually expert in whatever field it is say, you know, that no, that's wrong. It's much more complicated. But we have this great tradition which feeds into our whole, you know, our national dream or myth of, you know, anyone can recreate themselves in this way, that makes that kind of expert advice very appealing in business and in love, I think.
Yeah. So you say that there's a lot of pressure, but there's not a lot of support. So what would that support look like? I mean, you write about making larger changes. You mentioned like political changes, like directing efforts outward with these, you know, you say concrete fixes that could make dating better. So what does that look like? What is that?
Yeah, this is the million-dollar question, is how to make it better. I mean, I think that in terms of our own individual lives, I do really hope that my book is at least somewhat helpful in terms of restoring the kind of clarity that we were talking about earlier. I mean, I think, at least in my personal experience, nothing was more helpful, actually, for finding a kind of happy, romantic, sexual life than stepping back from all that kind of advice that's telling you to hate yourself and not follow your feelings and play all these games. So I do think that at an individual level, stepping back from that kind of advice, I do think valuing friendships and other kinds of networks and love of love and care does take some of the like crazy pressure off the search to find a mate, acknowledging that you don't have to. There's a new book called All the Single Ladies by Rebecca Traister, who I did a show with recently, where she talks about, you know, we hear so much about how we'll be so unhappy if we're single, but a lot of married people are unhappy too. I mean, this idea that finding a certain kind of relationship is going to fix everything in your life, I think is sadly, you know, not true. So I think at an individual level, stepping back from this whole culture of anxiety and the way we're always being told to work harder can be helpful. I'm always, you know, I live in Northern California. I'm an advocate of open communication and sort of emotional vulnerability. I think that the way these market metaphors of scarcity have so informed how we think about dating, where, you know, you have to play hard to get and not give things away too easily, I think that they're very, I don't know, I think there's something really destructive about them. And I know it sounds sort of like I'm saying we should replace finance capitalism with a hug or something. But part of me thinks that, you know, we can be more generous toward ourselves and our partners. The idea that if you have a short relationship with someone, something I run into all the time is people say, you know, I have a quote unquote buddy. I don't know if I can say that on the radio. I have a friend with benefits. But what I want is a relationship. And people have this idea of a relationship. And that if something is not a relationship, then it's absolutely nothing. Yeah. And I think that that kind of binary thinking is really misguided and is very, but it's hammered home by this whole logic of scarcity where it's like, oh, well, don't waste any time in the massive gray area that constitutes almost all human experience in between, you know, that people feel like, oh, well, if it's not a relationship, it's nothing. And I think that that's misguided. I think that I would encourage people to just take a little more time and be more generous with themselves and their partners in that area. And then I do think that the social and systemic things are important. You know, these aren't things any one person can change. But I think that work culture and the way that, you know, as American wages have stagnated and jobs have gotten more precarious, those of us who are like floating in this economy accept that we have to work all the time and we're supposed to love our work. You know, we say love what you do, which sounds nice and is great work if you can get it. But the flip side is, you know, if you don't love your job folding sweaters at the Gap or serving coffees at Starbucks, it's like some personal failure. So I think that, for instance, I think that having like working less would be one of the best things we could do for romantic and human relationships. That's not a thing. You know, we can't lean out one by one. It doesn't work that way. But I do think certain like broader cultural changes like that would create more romantic and sexual happiness. But they can only be done through political movements. You know, those kinds of things can't be done one by one.
Yeah, but I started to wonder whether or not it was even possible to. I mean, because one of the things you write about is we have to find a way to fall out of these outdated patterns. To find love. And you, there's this thing you refer to as we should find this like third sexual revolution.
Right.
But I was wondering, like, if we're so impacted, if dating has always been so impacted by economy and culture, is it even possible to separate, to create a new pattern? If that is the pattern, if we're just bound to, I mean, how do you get away from that?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, by creating a better economy and culture at the same time, I think that maybe that's sort of an unfathomably big answer. But I do think that that is the answer. And I think we're seeing it. I mean, I think that we are seeing a new kind of political energy from young people and we see these new social movements. I do think, again, those connections are very perhaps abstract or feel very attenuated in certain ways. But I do think we're seeing certain kinds of social revolution among people a little, I'm like in 31, so people a little bit younger than I am mostly.
Yeah.
And I think that energy, which I do see is reflecting a certain kind of social love, like a rejection of this every person for him or herself, pretty loveless, I think, model where the market is supposed to, that's supposed to be the logic of all of life. I do think we're seeing some of that. So that's very, the third sexual revolution is a big project, and people have definitely said, like, okay, so what's the plan? I don't know if I have a perfect answer. We should recognize that
love is about labor. It's work, and just reclaim that. And part of what you said, and you were sort of referring to this earlier, is that's going to mean being willing to be more vulnerable.
Yeah, for sure. I think that it's, you know, the idea of pointing out that there is this element of work in private life makes people very uncomfortable often, or it's like a hard thing to reckon with. I think in particular, you know, as a feminist, I find this among certain kinds of men who think of themselves as very progressive in many of their ways of thinking, but then sort of get really upset if you point out that, you know, their girlfriend listens to them way more than they listen to her and like helps them with their project. So I think that people are resistant often to thinking about how these labor dynamics play out in private life. But I do think that reclaiming that and owning that, and also seeing that that means that we can reshape the world how we want. I mean, that's, I mean, to me, again, I'm in Northern California. That's the point of being alive, right? Like, desire is this thing we're given that makes us want other people. That means we get to recreate the world each generation, which, you know, doesn't necessarily mean you have to get straight married and have kids. Maybe it means you live with friends, or, you know, that you have multiple lovers. But it really is this opportunity. And I think recognizing, to put it this way, that love is not just about biology. It's not that we just have these eternal instincts that we have to satisfy in some narrow set of ways, and the changing economy means it's harder and harder to get that narrow thing. Recognizing that it's like a thing that we create in time and as a process is actually, I think, really exciting.
Moira Weigel, her new book is called Labor of Love: The Invention of Dating. She joined us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced today by Tony Liu. The program also produced, of course, by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.